just wanted, first of all, to say thanks very much for inviting me. I'm really looking forward to the discussion and the questions, because this is a paper in process, and I really need feedback and insights from others who perhaps work on this kind of topic. This topic is new to me. It's basically responsive mode ethnographic research, when a new phenomenon is happening in the place where you've done lots of field work, and so you decide to explore it and investigate it. So I'm not claiming to be an expert in village savings and loans associations or small-scale credit in sub-Saharan Africa or indeed elsewhere. So I'm relying on you for help and input here. So the paper is about development, as much as my recent work has been about. But it's not about development as something which is done to people, which most anthropologists normally write about. It's about development which people do for themselves. And this paper explores the successful dissemination of an organisational form which was designed explicitly to be appropriated to enable development. And the form is the Village Saving Association, the kind of group that you see often on adverts for NGOs and community development internationally, and the kind of group that you may see in villages and cities if you work especially in rural Africa or South Asia. So lots of us have probably seen groups like this with a cash box. So what are village savings associations? What are they? They're groups consisting of between 12 and 30 people who meet regularly in order to contribute money in an annual cycle so that they can provide loans to each other and to generate returns on savings. They're presented by the organisations who promote them in NGOs and government agencies alike as integral to the much vaunted microfinance revolution, and they've expanded exponentially in Asia and Africa since the 1990s. They've got a longer history, but the expansion has been more recent. This expansion is not simply a result of donor funding and their insertion within large-scale financial inclusion programmes, nor can it be explained by the alignment of savings narratives with neoliberal ideologies of economic empowerment. That's what I'm saying anyway. The specifics of organisational form play a pivotal role in their diffusion. And as we'll see in the paper, the practices of the village savings associations that I'm going to look at are deliberate composites of indigenous and bureaucratic institutional forms characterised by extremely high levels of formalisation. And so what this paper does is it explores the role of formalisation in the ongoing extension of village savings and loans associations in rural southern Tanzania and possibly elsewhere. And I'm going to argue that formalisation is key to their expansion, not necessarily because of financial formalisation, although this is relevant, but because of what this formalisation of practice enables. And I'm going to suggest that savings associations adopt the organisational properties of ritual to generate and sustain autonomous local institutions. The ritualisation of group practices, I suggest, renders the regulatory activities of saving memorable and replicable, and it simultaneously enacts the formalities necessary for accounting for returns on savings. So into the sort of chunk of the paper proper. So village savings and loan associations are an expanding transnational cultural form. They're promoted by governments, NGOs, and philanthropic organisations like Gates. Presented as a pathway to formal sector microfinance providers and as necessary steps on the ladder of financial inclusion, they're claimed to comprise a middle rung on an evolutionary ladder of formalising financial institutions. This evolutionist interpretation is not confined to producers of neoliberal policies which seek to maximise the synergies between financialisation and economic empowerment. We as anthropologists have been partly responsible for the fetishisation of savings associations as positive steps on the path towards capitalist inclusion. Clifford Geertz's analysis of the Javanese Arizan led to the identification of what he called the Rotating Credit Association as an ubiquitous organisational form which was intermediate between formal sector financial institutions and individual saving. For Geertz, institutions like the Arizan were a spontaneous organisational response to the assumed problems of transition from agrarian to modern social forms, and from traditional to general purpose currencies. They created, Geertz suggested, a social space in which commercial financial practices around the management of money could be performed without contravening the tenets of traditional peasant moral economy. Middle run and financialization thinking have certainly informed the rationale for the kinds of large-scale programs oriented towards the expansion of savings associations, which are implemented by donor-funded organizations in many African countries over the past decade. And the drive to scale, therefore, favors proven systems through which groups can assure returns on members' savings. A single organizational template for the operation of these savings associations is fast becoming the industry standard across the development sector, supported by an expanding infrastructure of resources and expertise. What's called, it's actually called this, the VSLA methodology, they call it a methodology, is a system for the establishment, operation, and self-management of village savings and loans associations. Developed in the late 1990s by practitioners working for Care International in its West Africa programs, it's since been exported to poor communities around the globe. Although most interventions disseminating this model are typically of two or three years' duration, they've been extremely successful, even in areas where the prior existence of local forms of saving association was very limited. And what's perhaps more remarkable is the extent to which the groups initiated through these programs maintain themselves through successive cycles, often with changed membership, and they also provide fertile ground for the formation of new groups. So the success of the methodology is in propagating these self-sustaining organisational forms. In parts of Tanzania where savings groups were either not well known or non-existent, they've become an accepted part of the local institutional landscape. And this is the case in Ulanga district, a rapidly changing agricultural district in the sort of south-central part of Tanzania, where I've conducted several periods of anthropological fieldwork since the 1990s, from a situation where there were either no savings groups in the villages, which I knew in the 2000s, to a single project introduced two savings groups in 2005. Many villages in that 10-year period since then are now home to several savings groups, and many villages are members of multiple groups simultaneously. The VSLA groups have undergone similar trajectories of expansion in many countries in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. This kind of extension is not confined to Tanzania. Advocates of village savings associations explain this unprecedented extension in terms of their effectiveness as a financial technology which helps members achieve more control over their money. But to explain the diffusion of savings associations in terms of popularising the practice of saving doesn't account for the multiplication of this particular institutional form. That's what interests me. Membership of a VSLA group, which holds weekly meetings, is time-consuming, involving very specific practices, and it requires high levels of commitment. And the remainder of the paper considers the social factors which contribute to the diffusion of the VSLA form in diverse cultural settings. So let's look in a bit more detail at this VSLA methodology. The village savings and loans associations promoted by CARE are a type of accumulating credit and savings association. If any of you are into savings associations, they've got an acronym, of course, which is ASCA. Members buy weekly shares up to a set limit to create a cash reserve from which they can borrow variable amounts over a fixed time period. Savings accumulate through share purchase and the interest paid on loans. At the end of the cycle, the fund is divided proportionally in relation to shares among members. In Tanzania, the extension of ASCAs is part of an explicit strategy on the part of government and external donors to deepen the social infrastructure for development as financialization. The institutional template of the savings groups currently distributed through development programs is a hybrid derived from the financial architecture of the ASCA in conjunction with a selection of the social practices associated with effective indigenous forms of local savings association, which recur throughout sub-Saharan Africa. The resulting form serendipitously draws on Indigenous modalities for the rotation of capital and labour, styles of political oratory, and the organisation of office holding, combined with the apparatus of bureaucratic audit. According to the narrative disseminated by CARE, which is a big part of the mythology surrounding the methodology, the VSLA model it promotes is actually African. It's derived from an accumulating savings association originating in Niger. Modified through the requirements of development programming to be manageable within project frameworks, CARE's methodology combines the elements of regular contributions and audit with the material form of the triple-locked cash box, a device which, together with the books in which savings of individual group members are recorded, enables the public performance of accountability. And again, you can see the cash box with different multiple locks on it. Cash boxes used by savings groups are three hasps on which different padlocks can be attached so that keys can be held by different members of the savings group. VSLA groups consist, as I've said, of between 12 and 30 people. The average is about 25 to 30. And in Tanzania, they purchase between 1 and 5 shares a week. And that's a compulsory unless you have difficulties and get a temporary exclusion. Borrowing usually starts 3 months into a cycle once the group has accumulated money to lend. And interest is a fixed fee based on a ratio of the amount loaned. And as I said, at the end of the cycle, in Tanzania, normally between 12 and 18 months, members receive the returns on savings. What's really interesting about the organisation of the savings groups is all transactions take place in public. The organisation of the savings association is designed to enable transparency and accountability. And this is assured through the spatial organisation of participation in which members sit in a circle facing the cash box. And at the end of the cycle, money is allocated to shareholders in what CARE called an action audit, which again, I think as an anthropologist, I found that very interesting, and which is an apt description of the accounting practices performed in public through which these groups aim to make saving safe. Financial and personal discipline are central to group practice, so members are fined for missing meetings, for arriving late, and for late payments. And meetings follow a strict order of proceedings under the direction of elected officers, chairperson, secretary, and treasurer. Written constitutions are encouraged, but despite the standardisation of formats, groups strive to differentiate themselves with having different names, for example, and in the price of shares. But the general structure and organisation is fairly standardised. Adaptability within a fixed form means that savings groups can work for a wide range of people at different ends of the income scale because there's variation in share prices and so on. And what this contributes, I think, to their popularity and their appeal. In Ulanga, some 4 years after the end of CARE's original programme, savings groups were becoming established as part of the local social environment. And they were known as CARE groups, Vikundivyat CARE. Whether they'd been formed by CARE or not, or the length of time they'd been operating, groups demonstrated high levels of conformity to the VSLA methodology. They also adopted very similar behaviour at meetings, which were highly formalised, including the sequencing of standardised practices and actions, which were accompanied by formalised speeches and refrains. And these practices of standardisation are partly concerned with sort of the disciplinary organisation of savings groups, as people like Eric Beyer has written about for savings associations in South Africa. But they also allow savings groups to replicate in self-organising because they make complex rules memorable. As a result, groups can be established fairly easily by people familiar with the routines, which structure, the rules through which value is added to savings. Shared knowledge of practice, in addition, distributes responsibility among group members through practices of counting, witnessing, and recording what happens to members' money. So audit is embodied in action, like the action audit phrase would suggest. In Ulanga, savings groups meetings are held at the same time and the same place according to a regular schedule. And each meeting follows a set sequence of activities under the direction of its leaders the chairperson, secretary, treasurer, and some groups have money counters. So this, oh, I thought that was the leaders. That's not the leaders. Here's a group of leaders sitting up there with their cash books in the box. All members are expected to attend. And in most saving groups, the space where the group is meeting is laid out to create a circle around the centre where the cash box is placed, where it's publicly visible. And the structure of a meeting is roughly as follows. The elected leaders, these are also the leaders of a group and the money counters, take their seats behind the cash box. Other members arrive. They take their positions in a semicircle, so we'd be sitting in the members' positions looking at the leaders. And each member has a number from 1 to 30, and they sit in number order, and all transactions of the group take place in using the numbers to identify the members, not names. The chair generally opens a meeting, calling on a member to say a prayer, and after this, three members who are key holders who are sitting in the group are summoned to come forward and to unlock the box. There we have a picture of unlocking or locking the box. And each key holder has a key to a single lock, and the padlocks are removed, after which the treasurer and secretary open the box, remove the contents, and display these to the membership. The contents of the cash box consist of ledgers, soft-down notebooks, calculator, pens, a rubber stamp and an ink pad with which the shares are recorded, and plastic containers of different sizes with lids which hold different kinds of money. And then they also contain, what's very important as well, the yellow books are the savings books of individual members in which their shares are recorded. And the shares are recorded with a stamp, which is often a fish, so that a lot of savings groups call shares fish. So the secretary takes the bundle of books out the box and calls members by number order to come and take the books and to check their balances. And that's a very important part of the meeting. So the books are handed out, attendance is recorded, the treasurer and secretary open the plastic tubs full of money, and all the money is publicly counted before any new money goes in. The money that's there is counted, and the treasurer may ask the group if they remember what the amounts were when they finished the last meeting, so it's about checking that things are the same. The totals are announced, group members respond with call-outs and responses, celebrating the actions of saving. Give it's rising, you reap what you sow, which they will also shout at when people go up to buy their shares, again, all in public. So members are called once again by member number for their contribution, first of all, to a social fund which helps people who have difficulties or who are sick, then share purchase, again, in number order, to cheers or clapping or call-outs, celebrating saving. And then the final section of the meeting deals with loan repayments, which are also publicly announced and calculated, and other kinds of financial outstanding issues are discussed publicly in front of the group. Finally, any claims on the emergency social fund are considered based on the rules that the group has set out in its constitution. To close down the meeting, the cash allocated to the various components of the savings group practice is recounted, inscribed in the ledgers, and money and individual saving books are returned to the box. The lid is closed, and the key holders come up again and close the box, lock it. Everybody stands, and the meeting is over. At the end of a savings group cycle, the structure of the meeting is very similar, except that the final calculation establishes the value of members' shares and returns the cash saved along with savings books to the members of the group. Otherwise, the savings books go back in the box with the cash. The whole process of a savings group meeting can take a couple of hours. if not longer. And the end of cycle distribution can take 5 or 6 hours. So it's quite a big commitment, and it's quite complicated, especially if it's a large group which has quite a lot of money. So what do we make of these kinds of saving groups? An organisational form that's quite cumbersome, although it's quite effective in some ways. What do we make of this expansion and their popularity? And to answer that in terms of the kind of financialisation narrative, they're partly popular because they allow people to look after money, but they don't necessarily lead to huge returns on savings. Because if you're going to get returns on savings, it depends on other people borrowing sufficiently, and also it depends on other people returning what they borrow, and not everybody returns loans. So some groups are less successful than others. Some groups with very low share values don't generate huge returns. And although some of the higher income people, like on the first slide, the sort of leaders who are part of the business elite of the town, manage savings groups very successfully where they have shares at high value and they regularly borrow, so it generates interest. Some of the more rural and peripheral groups, it's more of a social activity than returning huge amounts of interest from owners. And for many people in the poor rural villages, loan taking was exceptional rather than usual and was oriented towards meeting family expenses. It's not the foundation of sort of entrepreneurial citizenship. In groups like that, borrowing is not merely an optional benefit of participation. It can be an actual requirement of membership because they recognise that people actually aren't necessarily seeking credit despite the financialisation narrative. So members had to be seen to borrow in order to contribute interest, which would produce returns for other members of the group. This logic of mutuality, in which some members should not be permitted to profit at the expense of other members, extended to the ways that groups organised the purchase and resale of commodities like sugar and soap powder to members for profit. So rather than operating as a discount club, which resold items at a knockdown price to members, the intention was to sell them at a profit to members because you'd be increasing the value of members' shares by increasing the amount of money available to the group. These kinds of practices, which seem sort of counterintuitive, are not in fact that unusual when you start reading around the literature on similar kinds of saving practices in low-income settings. Indeed, much of the appeal of small-scale saving associations is their usefulness in allowing people to manipulate money in time to draw down or accumulate larger sums. Therefore, members of savings associations are more likely to conceptualise their financial practices in terms of saving rather than credit, which again is what Parker Shipton's work reinforces. And this is achieved through what the microfinance analyst Stuart Rutherford calls saving up, in which money is set aside for future utilisation, or saving down, in which money is taken now for repayment later. So what we would call credit, they would call, Stuart Rutherford calls saving down. Because from this perspective, the difference between debtor or creditor status is essentially a matter of timing. Non-repayment of a loan may be justified by savings group members as an advance reclamation on their own savings. Well, it's my money anyway. Such behaviour allows the defaulter to take back what they've put in, but undermines the principles through which these groups exist to promote saving, conceptualised in terms of increasing the value of money saved rather than safekeeping. So there's this perpetual pull between saving as safekeeping and saving as increasing in value. And this tension between these different conceptualisations of what saving is recurs in savings associations throughout the region in various forms, some of them more indigenous than others. Examples from elsewhere in Africa suggest that saving as safeguarding of money from claims which could be made on it has been prioritised over saving as a means to increase the value of money saved. And what Parker Shipton, again, has referred to as an illiquidity preference thus contributes in large part to the appeal of savings associations for individual savings. I.e. if you make your money illiquid, then other people can't have claims on it. This preference is not in actuality a financial preference determined by the place of money in social relations. It's social relations which determine the place of money and who has claims and rights to it, as well as the constitution of value. And what savers are seeking to do through saving is to temporarily instantiate different kinds of social relations around certain kinds of money, so to make it inaccessible to others. But the objective of safekeeping is problematic in savings associations where liquidity is shared and value accumulated through circulation. That is, if you don't trust yourself with money and you don't trust your family with money, you've got to put money somewhere for it to be kept safely. But what savings associations are doing is putting it with other people who also can't be trusted. So the big challenge for savings associations is to manage that difficulty through trying to make money which is out in circulation visible and controllable, so that some kind of transient temporary trust is generated. So trust is central to creating the conditions under which money in circulation can return to those who have a claim on it within and beyond the group. The practice of savings associations, therefore, explicitly acknowledges that financial trust can't be generalised. So mechanisms which establish trust, albeit transiently, have to operate within the group. And this is what it seems to me the savings associations are trying to do. In contrast to systems which emphasise the trustworthiness of an individual through indices as personal knowledge or reputation or creditworthiness, which can somehow travel with them and that reputation stays with the person. They don't need to physically demonstrate it. Their reputation works. Savings associations rely on co-presence to generate trust, and they perform financial practices in public on the particular occasions of the groups. Visibility and transparency are primary mechanisms through which trust can be established directly. Reputation doesn't work in savings associations, and in fact personal identity is de-emphasised. So your name doesn't help you. You're reduced to an account holder, a number. Because money in its material form can't be in two places at the same time, its management within savings associations necessitates the constitution of financial instruments through which money can be seen to be safeguarded, representationally at least, while it's in circulation. So group practices therefore play on the metaphor of vision, invoking the promise of potentiality, which derives from hidden money and from its display, as well as on ledgers and balances, which are looked at and displayed and called out in public. In addition to visibilising money and its claim relations, group practices emphasise separation and calculation, which delineate between a person's individual commitments and their financial obligations to the group, and that those practices become the focal point of savings group meetings. So, and in the Tanzanian VSLA groups, these practices of separation and calculation and differentiating between the individual's social claims on money and their group, their obligations to the group, are effected through the extreme formalisation of group practices and the use of instruments for the calculation and containment of currencies, the tubs and the cash box, and the behaviour within the frame of the savings group. The practices of savings groups establishes boundaries between circuits of money inside and outside the group, and between the different kinds of money within it, whether it's for the social fund, whether it's a loan that's gone to other people, whether it's people's savings. And while this is represented abstractly through the financial descriptions in the form of ledgers and savings books, in unregulated financial environments where social norms around personal financial responsibility remain grounded in personal relationships, the level of trust which would ensure that the amounts transcribed in ledgers would stand in for actual sums don't exist. So you can't rely on the ledgers. You have to actually count the money and reconcile the money publicly to the ledgers and the saving books. And it's public performance which demonstrates saving primarily as an effect of relations between group members and their money in the form of actual cash and balances, which, though abstract, can be attached to specific account holders who are de-individualized. Such practices strive to resolve the disjuncture between the representation of saving as an effect of accounting, that is, as an effect of money gain value through adherence to calculative rules, and the centrality of relations between group members, which determine whether and how tangible money from some individuals can return to other individuals in the group. So they're trying to resolve the fact they don't trust each other and they don't trust ledgers. The only way of creating that kind of trust is to actually act it all out in public with tangible money. Savings groups meetings, therefore, are tightly choreographed events in which the social identities of members are superseded by their identities as account holders. This involves the merging of person and account through using member numbers as titles during meetings, conducting interactions in meetings in number order, and dealing with any group business during meetings as between the savings group and a member number. So if someone has a personal problem, they're dealt with as an account holder, as a savings group member, not as an individual who's known, in a sense. It's according to the strict rules of operation. Account holding as a status is realised at group meetings where members literally take hold of their account books and, in participating in the public transactions of group business, hold each other to account. Just as persons as members become account holders through the group meeting at which their personal identities are replaced by their account number, holders' relations with their books are confined to the time and space of the savings meeting. They don't take them out of the meeting. Savings books are kept together with group ledgers and cash in the lock box between meetings. The cash box is extremely important as the vehicle which encapsulates the activity and identity of the group. The multiple locks enable the distribution of responsibility through designated key holders, creating the conditions under which others can be trusted with cash. Now, obviously, there's occasions when people can break the locks off and stuff. It is, you know, we're anthropologists, it's partly symbolic, you know. But people take it incredibly seriously. The key holder thing is supremely important, and the multiple lock thing is highly valued by group members. Just as the group needs the box in order to function in conformity with the rules, the box requires the group in order to function, because you need the key holders. If a single key holder is missing, the box can't be opened. So the box operates as the artifact which makes savings possible by containing member accounts. This is done through holding the account books and the records of saving, and through holding the money, which is sorted into the different containers. The metal box contains the activity of the group in two forms: as cash, which can be counted at meetings, and as accounts through the savings books and ledgers. By including the cash which is not in the box, because it's with members as loans awaiting payment, the total resources of the group can be accounted for orally and in ledgers. It's all brought together in the box. So the box, like the group of which it's part, is fundamental, bringing the group together as a frame and framework for the practices of the group. So what can we conclude from this sort of overview of the practices of village savings and loans associations in Tanzania at the moment? What are the ways we could analyse it or think about it using anthropology? So the practice of saving in any cultural setting demands the setting apart of money from those who would otherwise have moral claims to it, as many theorists have said. And as Michel Cannon and others have shown, the constitution of the auditable economy is similar in a sense, that it depends on a fixed reference frame around values and transactions, which is so distinct from everyday practices around money that its enactment requires formalisation, that a formal financial system is sort of an idealised social order. And you can see that kind of framing and ideal social order being instantiated in the practice of savings group as a kind of formal space constituted as an action audit where money can be represented as following financial rules, as moving and providing a return on value between depersonalised accounts. So it's operating as a financial system. And the formalisation of practice affects the framing, in Cannon's terms, of saving as a processual space where money can be seen to gain value through adherence to the rules of calculation performed in public, which can then be inscribed in the ledgers that contain the transactions of the group. And as we've seen, this is made possible through those series of practices of depersonalization and abstraction and formalization. The formalization of savings group practices is articulated through the sequencing of standardized actions of separation and calculation, which structure a rhetorical performance which generates a distinction between practices inside and outside the frame. But such device making through repetition is characteristic of another kind of social practice that anthropologists are familiar with, and I think which offers us some ways of perhaps understanding how these organisational forms can reproduce themselves. Device making through repetition is a characteristic of ritual, which makes use of formulaic sequences of actions and utterances to create a temporary separation from ordinary practices across a range of contexts. The ritualization of savings group practices is not merely metaphoric. It's the vehicle through which these groups organize themselves and the financial system which produces the effect of saving. Aspects of savings group practice replicate the social effects of ritual, enabling the reproduction of their practice and its reiteration, as the rules which comprise the formal order of accounting are embodied in practical routines. As Handelman and others have suggested, it's the self-organising properties of ritual which accord it productive possibilities, contributing to the ease with which these particular social forms are appropriated wherever they appear. The practice of savings groups, as indeed accounting practice more generally, seeks to create the conditions under which money can operate impersonally, as it were, detached from social relations. As Graeber suggests, this is not, in actuality, an inherent property of money or its abstraction. The apparent depersonalization of money has to be created through complex social processes which permit money to be seen to operate within what is represented as a financial system, but which recognize its continual flow between and between more idiosyncratic circuits of value and exchange. The partial autonomy and self-organizing properties of ritual come into play here as a device through which different social orders can be temporarily enacted and reenacted. So you're sort of setting up a pop-up frame for the enactment of a financial sector. Rituals, Handelman suggests, attain durability as institutions because they're autonomous to varying degrees from their socio-cultural surround at the same time as they refer back to it, which I think applies to savings associations. Savings associations which exploit ritual forms seem to me to exhibit similar potentialities, a temporary space of separation from what might actually happen to money and the fluctuation of value. As institutional devices which enable the temporary separation and delineation of alternate social orderings, they complement the frame-making and abstraction of accounting instruments, structuring action audits as performative practice. In the example of savings associations, the self-organising properties of ritual are used, let me just double check, sorry. And yeah, self-organising properties of ritual are used productively to propagate autonomous local financial institutions. Again, savings associations don't need a larger umbrella institutional setup to operate. They can be incorporated into bigger structures, but they don't need to be. Anthropological accounts of ritual, which focus only on its representational dimensions, obscure the institutional potential of ritual forms, which is an argument that Joel Robbins has proposed. The relations through which saving is affected constitute a financial order within a formal economy, which is partly a fantasy, based on a set of rules and obligations, which is constituted as being disinterested, which is very, very different from everyday social relations. Because, therefore, this order does not actually exist, it has to be created in formal economics through creative practices which exclude and frame, as Callon and others show, and through institutions which instantiate the rules for transactions within particular markets. Whereas religious rituals commonly address a separation between a chaotic present and an ordered past, you can tell I'm a Morris's student, formalisation as social artefact offers a greater range of creative possibilities. In the practice of savings groups, it's used productively to create boundaries between present and future, between personal interests and impersonal money, and between social and abstract enactments of the economy. Approaching the operation of savings associations through the frame of ritualization draws attention to the performativity of accounting as social practice and offers insights into the flourishing of these small-scale, autonomous and self-regulating financial institutions in highly monetized settings which are wholly integrated in capitalist economic relations. Savings associations are not, in fact, a middle-run. They're not exact middle-run financial institutions which mediate social relations around money in an evolutionist transformation from an embedded to a disembedded economy. On the contrary, as money in circulation moves between people across a range of relationships, commodification and decommodification, earmarking and abstraction are ongoing strategies which are used creatively to socialise economic relations. Ritualisation, in its temporary instantiation of alternate social orders, permits the double movement between embedding and disembedding, abstraction and materialisation, which is integral to the ongoing use and circulation of money. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.